Welcome to your commercial-free, uninterrupted investment show, sponsored by the SEC-registered investment firm, Wilsey Asset Management, a fiduciary firm owned and operated by President Brett Wilsey, who has been putting clients' investment needs first for over 40 years. The Smart Investing Show has been giving unbiased financial information for over 27 years on local radio stations right here in San Diego, providing you with fundamental analysis on stocks and investments you want to know about. Now, here are your hosts, Brent and Chase Wilsey.
Alrighty, welcome to the Smart Investing Show. I'm Chase Wilsey, Vice President at Wilsey Asset Management, and I'll be the host for the show today. As you may notice, no Brent Wilsey today, so we do have our financial planner from, again, Wilsey Asset Management, Harrison Johnson, in studio today. Harrison, how are we doing?
We're doing well today. Second time in 3 weeks that I'm here in the studio on the show, so we'll see which one of you, Brent or Chase, that does a better job.
I might be a little biased on that, but I guess our listeners can decide. But we got a great show for you here today. You know, obviously, talk of the town, as always, inflation. So we're going to be talking about CPI, PPI. Also, too, we want to look at 401ks. I was surprised there was a research note that came out that, I'm going to say, bashed 401ks a little bit in favor of pensions. I have some input on that particular topic. So we'll give you our opinion on 401ks, why we like them. Also, too, this little thing, Bitcoin. We're going to talk about Bitcoin and kind of talk about our perspective of what's going on with this whole Bitcoin craze, I'll call it, at the current point in where we're at in the cycle. Also, too, back half of the show, we do want to take a look at those companies we always like to break down. We'll give you our opinion, look through the valuations, the debt levels. We got four good businesses here that are quite popular. We're going to look at Costco, Marvell Technology. Interesting situation here with GAAP versus non-GAAP numbers. Got a good details for you as an investor. Probably a good learning experience to look at Marvell Technology. Also, to Southwest, they had some news, further issues with Boeing now impacting Southwest. And last one I want to talk about here is Kroger, the grocery store. So, got a great show here. We'll get into it. We'll start again with the inflation news, because obviously that's been kind of driving the market here the last couple of years. Questions over what the Fed is going to do, what they might not do. So we'll start here by looking at CPI, which again is the Consumer Price Index. Well, it came in a little bit hotter than expected, as the headline number for February showed an annual increase of 3.2%. versus an expectation of 3.1%. And then the core CPI showed an annual increase of 3.8% versus an expectation of 3.7%. While it was not much progress, there was still a decline from last month's core CPI reading of 3.9%. This actually marked the lowest reading since May 2021, when core CPI again matched that 3.8% level. So, you know, a lot of people may have thrown a little bit of, I'll call it, a hissy fit over the inflation report, but it is still the lowest that we've seen in nearly 3 years. Food was a bright spot in the report, as the annual increase was just 2.2%, and food at home actually came in at an annual increase of 1%, while food away from home increased 4.5%.
With wage pressures continuing, we believe this discrepancy will continue. Energy was also an interesting sector, as the annual reading showed a decline of 1.9%, but the monthly reading was up 2.3%. Energy has been a big positive for the headline number, but as we lap easier levels, it will likely not be as big of a benefit. One of the areas that remains very hot is motor vehicle insurance, as it was up 20.6% compared to last year. We believe this item will remain hot for the next several months, but as we lap higher prices, it should subdue. Shelter also remained a large weight on the report, as it increased 5.7% over the last year and accounted for about two-thirds of the annual increase in core CPI. We feel like we sound like broken records over here, but we continue to believe that this is heavily distorting the numbers, and as it declines over the remainder of the year, it should be a benefit to both headline and core CPI. Now, I don't believe this report does anything to change the expectation for potentially three cuts in the back half of the year.
And I just got to talk about the shelter index. We talk about it every month, and I'm just going to say it's the silliest thing. I mean, you talk about the owner's equivalent rent, and we hit pretty hard on this last month, but for those that didn't hear it, it's like somebody calls you up with a survey and says, "Hey, Joe Smith, how much do you think you can rent your house out for?" what does the average person, frankly, know about the rental market?
And even if they did know, people are always going to overestimate their own benefit. Oh, yeah, I think my house is really worth this. I think I could rent it out for that. So people are always going to favor to the higher side of that, which the fact that that influences these CPI numbers, I mean, is a little bit misleading, really.
I mean, because if you look at the real-time data from, you know, I was listening to CNBC this morning, or yesterday, excuse me, they were talking about just kind of the real-time numbers from Zillow, Redfin. I mean, they're still nowhere near where the CPI report has been, which again has distorted the numbers. So and we saw it as well in PCE last month, which is the Fed's preferred measure for inflation, much more subdued than the CPI. I'm curious if we're going to see that again in the month of March for, well, February numbers. And again, I'm going to say that the CPI report might be a little bit more broken and maybe not as good of an indicator of what the Fed is thinking. Don't get me wrong, you should still look at it. But if the shelter index continues to be weighted this way and kind of distorting the numbers, I don't know how reliable of an indicator it'll be going forward.
And I mean, the good thing is the Fed is looking at all these different indicators, not just that shelter index. And, you know, they've said it all along, they're going to be slow to cut rates. And really, you know, when we look at these numbers, 3.2, 3.1, that's a whole lot lower than what we've been seeing the last couple months and really the last couple years. And so now that we're showing levels that are similar to 2021, I mean, when you think back to 2021 and where inflation was at and what interest rates were at, I mean, a totally different situation to compared to where we're at now. So we are seeing the numbers that we want. You know, these last rates came out a little bit higher than what people were expecting, but not by much. And still, you know, numbers in the low threes is still very promising as we go through the rest of this year.
Well, I mean, kind of talking, I'm going to say about a little bit of an overreaction in my opinion, and maybe the numbers not being exactly where people were anticipating. I got to say, I was surprised by the producer price index and kind of the negative reaction that came about from it. It seems as if people were fixated on the monthly jump of 0.6%, which doubled both the estimate and January's reading of 0.3%. Yeah, oh my gosh, sounds terrible, right? Well, let's look at this year over year. And though the numbers still look quite manageable, if we look at the headline number as it increased 1.6%, and core PPI, which excludes food and energy, was up 2%. Well, what did we just say the Fed's target was? 2%. I mean, we're there essentially. And what does the PPI not have that the CPI does? The shelter index. So I think that this inflation problem, don't get me wrong, it's still there and lingering somewhat, but I think people are blowing this out of proportion in terms of, oh my gosh, this last mile is going to be so difficult and it's so sticky, and maybe now we're going to get no Fed rate cuts this year. I frankly think that would be a terrible mistake to actually look at doing that with PPI.
Yeah, and I mean, when you look at the market's reaction to this, they were unfavorable, but the markets have also been, you know, kind of on a tear since October. And so when you look at where we were October of last year, people were thinking that we were going to start to see substantial rate cuts in the first part of 2024. So, you know, we didn't see those cuts. We still believe that we will as we get into the second half of this year. But there could be just some cooling on the fact that, you know, there was so much hype baked into the fact that they thought rates were going to be cut earlier.
And the funny thing, I say funny thing, but I think the important thing that people need to understand, I've said this before, an area that does worry me a little bit is energy. And it's funny because we look at core, which excludes energy, but energy prices still really drive a lot of expenses for businesses, which then get passed down to the consumers. I worry that if we have too major of an energy spike, that could actually be what causes inflation to be more problematic. So I think that is something to keep an eye on because, yeah, that could cause some problems down the road if energy did spike.
Yeah, and the other thing to kind of keep in mind is this is, you know, when we look back a couple years ago, prices are a whole lot higher than what they were, and prices are not going to go back to the nominal level that they were. We're just trying to, you know, reduce the amount of increase that we're seeing on prices. So inflation's cooling down, but, you know, we're not going to go and be able to buy food or go out to eat for the cost that we could in 2019.
Yeah, that's a great point, because a lot of times people are like, oh, well, the prices compared to 2019. It frankly doesn't matter.
It's like a sunk cost at this point. Yeah, those unfortunately are not coming back.
Yeah, but I mean, it's funny when you talk to people and they're like, oh, but you also have to look at wages and assets. Would you trade off lower prices if you got paid less and your house and your stock portfolio and your assets declined in value?
No.
That's just not going to happen. You're not going to have deflation and then not have, you know, declining wages, a weak economy. That's why we're not going to see 2019 levels. It is going to continue to grow in price. And yes, prices are going to continue to grow up. And that, you know, it's funny, I talked to Brent about, you know, when he could go to the movies for a nickel. That has never happened in my lifetime. And it's like, yeah, 20 years from now, if we still have movie theaters, I think we will, prices will be more expensive. It's just a natural progression of inflation, but it is healthy for the economy. We just need to make sure it's increasing at a healthy level, not at 10% or anything crazy like that. Well, that's kind of where we stand on inflation. And again, I still got to stick to the fact that we still think that the Fed is sticking to what the Fed has said, that they'll do 3 rate hikes probably back part of this year. I don't know where the market at the beginning of the year thought they were going to do 6, but it looks like we will kind of hit that 3. I still think 4 is the right level, but I think the Fed's going to be pretty strong on sticking to that rate path. I think likely 3 for 2024 is what the Fed's going to proceed with, which I think will still be positive for the right companies. But moving on here, did want to talk about the 401k setup, as I kind of teased with at the beginning there. And it's no secret that, frankly, we're big advocates of saving in your 401k. But I was surprised to see that according to a recent survey, 77% of workers believe that the unavailability of pensions is making it harder to achieve the American dream. And 83% say all workers should have a pension to be independent and self-reliant in retirement. I was also surprised to see some UAW, again, the United Auto Workers members, that they were still unsatisfied with the automakers' retirement plans, as some are continuing to push for pensions.
A Ford spokesperson recently shared the current retirement structure at their company. And I mean, when you look at these numbers, this is pretty generous, I would say. So the company contributes 10% of an employee's base wages plus 1% per hour worked, capped at 2,080 hours per year, which is working 40 hours a week full-time for the whole year, with zero employee contribution required. So again, a 10%, not a match, because you don't have to contribute to get this, 10% of your wages plus another $2,080 a year if you're working full-time, put into the 401k by the employer on the behalf of employees. So we would take that over defined benefit plan, pension plan, any day. 401ks give participants the power to grow their wealth more effectively. They're much better estate planning tools because there actually is estate planning involved in them. With a pension, there's no estate planning or benefit at all. And they are much more portable if you change employers. You can keep that 401k with you. The key is you have to take accountability and actually participate in your 401k to reap the benefits, and you got to invest that money.
Yeah. It's more self-control, essentially, and it just seems like a lot of people just want things done for them. But I mean, gosh, I look at this, and the 401k, I think, has enabled people to build their own wealth so much more effectively than, yeah, you get a pension and, yeah, maybe you get $3,000, $4,000 in retirement. That's it. Once you pass away, it makes it difficult, too. If you have a spouse, you got to take a cut maybe in the income to have the spousal benefits in there, where if you just build your 401k assets, maybe you can retire early. You wouldn't be able to do that if you had a pension.
Well, I mean, there's a whole lot more investment flexibility. There's more tax flexibility. There's the estate planning flexibility of it. And I mean, if someone said, oh yeah, I've got a pension where if I work for this company for 30 years, that I'll get a pension that's 80% of my salary. I mean, people look at that as being very lucrative, like a really good pension. But if you were to, I mean, looking at Ford's example, if you got a 10% contribution plus, you know, I mean, if you make $100,000 a year and you get an extra $2,000, that's really like a 12% non-elective contribution. If you invested that and even had a modest rate of return over a 30-year span, that plus any contributions you put in there will likely generate more than 80% of your income for all of retirement and all of your spouse's retirement, and that money can be retained by your family and pass on to heirs. So, you know, people look at pensions as, oh, well, that's why we have this retirement crisis in America, which pensions take the responsibility away from the employees. But, you know, if you can be disciplined and use your 401k or any type of investment vehicle efficiently, you can use it to provide a whole lot more value than what a pension can do for you.
And I mean, we have clients that are working and we don't get paid anything for them putting money into their 401ks. I always tell people, put money into your 401ks. We don't make money off of that. That is honestly the best, I think, investment tool that you truly have. I mean, you get tax benefits. If you have a company match, there's no other place you can instantaneously get a 100% return just by putting money into the plan. I mean, it's truly the best thing out there, and if you're not taking advantage of it, it's a huge mistake. I don't care what anybody tells you.
Yeah, it's absolutely a mistake to not be using your 401k. And, you know, there's people out there that make you the argument that 401ks are bad because you're putting pre-tax money in there, and that's going to be taxable in retirement. I'm going to talk more about that. But more and more 401ks these days are offering Roth components. So if you're that worried about the tax side of it, you can make Roth contributions and then get tax-free money in retirement. But, you know, the 401ks have such high contribution limits this year. If you're over 50, $30,500 a year can go into your 401k plus whatever your employer matches or contributes on your behalf. So, you know, that number could be $40,000 or more per year. It doesn't take that many years of $40,000 a year into an account for that account to then replace the amount of income that you could get working for yourself.
Yeah, it's, again, something we highly encourage you to do. If you have a 401k, take part in the 401k, invest the money in the 401k. Don't just leave it in cash. There's a lot of great tools that can help you over time. Make sure you're taking part in that.
And back to this point where, you know, 77% of workers believe the unavailability of pensions make it harder, and 83% say that workers should have pensions to be independent and self-reliant. If you want a pension that bad, use your 401k and buy an annuity. All annuity is a pension. And we dog on annuities all the time because we think they're inefficient vehicles because they don't perform as well as a 401k can. But again, annuity, all an annuity is from a technical perspective, is a source of cash flow. You get monthly cash flow, which is exactly what a pension is. So you can take your 401k money, you can retire, you can use that to buy an annuity. I'm sure an annuity salesman would be more than happy to take your money from you. And you can use that to create a pension.
Yeah. And just to confirm, that is not our recommendation.
Right. You know?
But if you truly believe in the pension system, then yeah, Harrison's right. You can do an annuity. But that's not what I would do. And that's why I think 401ks are so great, is because you can invest for your lifetime, your spouse's lifetime, and then pass that down to your heirs if you have heirs as well. And that's a good starting point for many of their investments. And it's an amazing vehicle that you just don't get with the pension at the end of the day.
And I think the important part about it is, we tell people to put money into their 401ks. We don't manage that, but that's the right thing to do. For many people, that's a priority of where they should be putting cash flow. Now we could say, you know what, use that money and invest it somewhere with us so we can manage it for you. But in many cases, that's not the right thing to do.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, and that's one thing we always look at. We want to do what's best for our clients. And again, the 401k is a great vehicle. With that, let's move on to, again, Bitcoin. And I got to admit it, that I really have no idea where Bitcoin will peak. And the truth is, no one really does. There's no way to value it at the end of the day. I do know, though, that demand is high right now because Wall Street continues to build their ETFs to collect their fees, which we've talked about before. But can we please get off some of the comparisons of Bitcoin to make one feel better, especially the one with gold and saying it is digital gold? The value of all mined gold is around $15 trillion. A good portion of that, well, it's in gold jewelry. Now, I know when I buy a gift for my wife or, you know, family members, well, they like that gold bracelet. They like a necklace, and they're going to be pretty happy there. But I can't even write the words how to compare if I gave her or a family member a piece of Bitcoin. Not the type of present that they would want at the end of the day. I think if I would try it, might be sleeping on the sofa there. Also, let's stop saying that this will be the replacement currency if the dollar falls. Just think of the calamity the country would go through with a fall of the dollar in the United States.
Do you think you'll still be able to plug in the internet and access your Bitcoin? You might not even have the electricity to plug in your electric devices like phones, computers, and laptops. Let's really understand what Bitcoin is. It is a speculative game that is being played right now, and it really cannot be used for anything that is really of any value. There are economists like David Kelly from JP Morgan who has similar feelings. He recently told Barron's. There's an article on Barron's with an interview on him, and he says, "I worry about the silly decisions investors make. People get misled by all sorts of fads and fantasies as to how they should invest. I worry about the money that's been pouring into things like Bitcoin, which is absolute nonsense. It is simply a focus of speculation. I worry that someday that'll all go poof and people will lose money." So it's pretty strong words from David Kelly from JP Morgan. And we've said it before. Congratulations if you've made a lot of money in Bitcoin. But if you want to continue to hold it, you should really think through what it is. And if you don't have a sound answer, you should look at selling it.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, we spent a lot of time in Bitcoin in the past, and it's a gambling chip. I mean, there's no cash flow, there's no assets, there's no earnings, there's no way to assign a target price to Bitcoin. It's only worth what the next person will pay for it. And right now, all this ETF craze, I'm going to say, has caused this demand influx. And I think it going higher has caused more people to want to get into it again. But we've seen it before when the shoe drops. I mean, it can fall very, very quickly.
And that's really what's happening. I mean, the reason why it's going up is because there's a greater number of people who are buying it and think or associate value with it than there are people who don't think that. And so that can cause things to increase. But same with the stock market. I mean, you can have people that think something's worth a lot of money, and so they're going to buy it. That's going to drive the stock price up. The difference is when we look at stocks, there's dividends, there's earnings, there's revenue in that company. They have a balance sheet. They have a P&L statement. They have, you know, conference calls that you can look through and see how that company is working. The same thing with real estate. With real estate, you have rents that you can look at. You can look at appreciation. You can look at the tax benefits. So there's something that is there that you can value. With Bitcoin, you know, it's gone up. It goes down, right? It could go to $1 million of Bitcoin. Who knows? It could also go to zero. And both of those are equally likely, I would say. There's really a high speculative degree in there. There's a lot like gambling. And to say, well, I bought Bitcoin, I knew it was going up, which is not true. Nobody knows it's going up or it's going down or it's going sideways or whatever it is. It's gambling at the end of the day. And I've got a friend who's a really good gambler. He won like $50,000 last month gambling. Does that mean that was a good financial decision? Probably not, because you have a really great chance of lose. And the similar thing could be said about Bitcoin. You know, just because it's gone up, don't use that as, you know, confirmation bias that they're doing the right thing, because it can just as easily go the other way for no reason whatsoever.
Yeah, and the moral of the story here is be careful when it comes to investing. You got to know your investments, and don't just think, oh, I know Bitcoin. What is it? You know, actually ask yourself, what is Bitcoin? If you can actually provide a sound answer, I haven't heard one yet, talked to many people about it, I would say sell it if you can't answer that question. But with that, we do want to move on to Harrison's financial planning topic here. Want to talk about tax brackets versus your tax rate. So I'm going to give the floor to you here, Harrison, and expand upon that topic.
So most people believe tax rates are going up, which may be true. With the level of government spending and debt we have, it is logical to conclude taxes will need to increase to keep up. Starting in 2026, the federal tax brackets are set to increase due to the sunset on the current tax rates that were implemented in 2018. We may also see further tax increases to address issues like the deficit or Social Security or Medicare or a range of different things that are underfunded. However, there is a difference between the tax brackets and the tax rate you will experience as an individual. Just because tax rates increase doesn't necessarily mean the rate you will be subject to will be higher or that your tax bill will be higher. Currently, the federal tax rates are 10 and 12%, 22, 24%, 32, 35, 37%, and they are expected to change to 10, 15, 25, 28, 33, 35, 39.6, which is technically an increase. Now, these are brackets, which means the more income that you have, the higher you get pushed up into those higher brackets. But what most people don't understand is that your individual level of income will also fluctuate up and down over time, not just the tax brackets themselves. So in retirement, you have much more flexibility in choosing where your income comes from. So while you're working, you might find yourself in the fourth tax bracket, which is 24% right now. But in retirement, with the right planning, maybe you can get down to the second tax bracket, which even after an increase, might be 15% at that time. So even though tax rates may have increased, the tax rate you would be subject to would go down because you'd be in a lower tax bracket due to how you structure your income. Now, I'm not saying taxes aren't a problem in retirement, because they absolutely can be, but the way to address them is to understand how your individual income will change over time so you can take advantage of the tax system all along the way.
And I mean, I think this kind of comes back, we were talking about earlier today, but you know, the Roth versus pre-tax 401k. I mean, I'm not telling you that Roth or pre-tax is better. It frankly depends on your tax situation and kind of where you're at in that phase of your work cycle. And you know, that's one way you kind of want to look at the tax brackets or Roth conversions. I mean, there's things that people should be doing to be proactive about this to help reduce their tax bill.
Yeah, I mean, the 401k, IRAs, all those accounts, Roth components, all of that are tools that you can use. So there's no one that's better than the other. The answer is it depends on where you currently are. And generally, people go through different tax phases when they're working. All the income that they have is ordinary income. Wages or self-employment income is ordinary income. So that takes up a lot of the room in the tax brackets. And you know, that can push you up, and that can be a high tax time for a lot of people. When you get into retirement, well, maybe you have some pension income, maybe you have some 401k withdrawals, maybe you have some Roth withdrawals, maybe you have some capital gains and dividends, maybe you have some interest, Social Security, rental income. All of those sources are, number one, flexible, because you can determine how much you want to withdraw from various accounts, when you're going to start Social Security, but also those sources are taxed differently. Capital gains and dividends are taxed at a lower rate. Interest is taxable as ordinary income. Pensions and 401ks are ordinary income. Roth withdrawals are not taxable. Withdrawals from taxable investment accounts are not taxable. So you can create cash flow. However, only some of that income that you're actually creating is reportable as income, which means it's a much easier to stay in the lower tax brackets. That doesn't last forever. As you get into later years in retirement, you have RMDs that you have to take from retirement accounts that can trigger, you know, being pushed up into higher tax brackets, and that can also trigger additional Medicare premiums that you have to pay. But the point is, you go through these different phases, and depending on what bracket you are in, that will tell you what to do. Should you fund a 401k? Should you fund a Roth? Should you make a conversion? Should you not? How much should you withdraw? How much room do you have in the current tax bracket that you're in? Should you find ways to defer income? Should you find ways to accelerate that income? And all of that is the planning that goes into how you structure that income. And there's nothing that you can buy that is going to make a difference. And I see a lot people coming back to the 401k. Oh, you never want to fund a 401k because tax rates are going up, and when you have to pull that out in retirement, you know, it's going to be taxed at a higher rate, which is not necessarily true.
Yeah, and you know, it is so important. You want that planning to start before you hit retirement. So go to our website, smartinvesting2000.com. You can set an appointment with Harrison there. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
You're riding high in April, shot down in May, but I know I'm going to change that.
Alrighty, welcome back to the second half of the Smart Investing Show. And gosh, that first half went by quick, and just got lost, caught talking about taxes, everyone's favorite thing. So forgot to promo our newsletter there. If you like the topics we covered, we do have additional ones as well on our website. You can sign up for our Smart Investing newsletter. We talk about military spending in China, Apple stock, kind of what's going on there with that particular company, kind of experience in investing. You know, Brent's been doing this for, gosh, over 40 years now, what he's kind of seen over time and what people should watch out for. Also, legal immigration, kind of how that's impacting the economy. So a lot of good topics there. Again, you want to sign up for our Smart Investing newsletter, go to our website, smartinvesting2000.com. Again, that's smartinvesting2000.com. All right, well, let's get into it. Talked about some companies at the beginning that we wanted to break down. The first one I want to talk about today was actually Costco. And obviously, we know Costco. We love Costco. I know Harrison loves to shop at Costco with his wife. They go there quite frequently.
I'm an executive member, so yeah, I love Costco.
And again, it's a great business. So I know that they reported earnings. It was last week that the stock actually fell a decent amount. I think it was like 7% or so after they reported earnings. There's some issues there. So I thought, hey, maybe we'll take a look at Costco and where those numbers kind of lie at this time. So currently, not much short on Costco stock, or ticker symbol again, COST. Short is only 1.4%. Institutional ownership, about 72.2%. Valuations, wow. Kind of surprised by this. Price to earnings multiple, 47.4, is above the industry average of 33.1. Price to sales of 1.3, also above the industry of 0.9. Price to tangible book value, 15.5. That is below the industry average of 31.7. But if you look at price to book, industry average is 7.1 versus Costco at 15.5. That's a lot for the assets and the equity of Costco. Also, too, price to cash flow of 30.3, essentially double the industry average of 15.1. Looking at earnings and sales growth over the last year, earnings are up 12.3% while the industry grew 19.3%, and sales were up 6.2% while the industry was up 11.2%. Five-year estimated growth rate going forward at 9.3%. And I always ask this question. I mean, how is Costco planning to grow? I mean, I know a lot of people with Costco memberships. The stores are always pretty full. There's a decent amount of stores. I'd say their footprint is quite large. Looking internationally to grow, where is that growth going to come from? Because, you know, that's a decent growth rate there. Looking at the dividend for Costco, negligible at 0.6%. They only use 26.6% of their earnings paid out. I do believe they are a company that pays a special dividend, though, from time to time, which is just once a year. So that is something to help drive that dividend yield a little bit higher. Now, looking at the balance sheet, good balance sheet here. Current ratio, 0.9. That's enough liquidity there for me. And debt to equity is only 0.5, which is below the industry average of 1.2. So I'd say it's a well-run company there in terms of their debt management. Net margin here, 2.7%, below the industry of 3%. Return on equity, wow, 32.7%. And return on invested capital, 23.1%. So again, good return numbers there. Not surprised. Costco, extremely well-run business. And again, a great business at the end of the day. Current price for Costco, though, $725.63. I see the 52-week high here, $787, and the 52-week low, $476.75. Now, if we go forward for Costco, we're going to look out going to, I believe they report on a calendar year. No, they actually do report on a fiscal basis, so their fiscal year ends August of each year. So we're going to go out to August 2025. I see estimated earnings per share here, $17.34. That would give us a target sell price of $287.84. Again, the current price for Costco, $725.63. That means that this company is trading at more than 40 times the estimated earnings. I'm just shocked. I mean, that's a very, very expensive stock here. And it's, again, we know a long-term average for companies is about 16 times. To trade at 42 with, you know, decent growth. They're looking for earnings growth of 9%. I mean, frankly, this stock makes way less sense to me than NVIDIA. And NVIDIA, yeah, it's gone up tremendously, but at least you're getting a huge, huge earnings growth rate. With Costco, very subdued earnings growth rate, and you're trading at more than 40 times earnings. I got to tell you, I would be very careful given the valuation of Costco. I mean, essentially, you're capping your estimated return here, because if earnings grow at 10%, I don't see how you can garner a higher multiple than really 40, 42 times. I mean, I guess it could go to 50 times, but what if that stock were to fall back to even 20 times earnings? Which is still an expensive multiple, that means the stock would be cut in half. I mean, Costco, gosh, expensive stock. I'd say stay away from this company here. A great business, go shopping there, but the stock is just, I'm going to say, too darn expensive.
I think this is one of those things where you really have to separate the business itself from what stock and what it's doing as an investment, because I love Costco. I'm still going to love Costco. I go there all the time. I use Costco Travel, and you go get your points and everything. So it's a good business, and you know, the goods there are not expensive, but when we look at what the cost is that you're having to pay for the stock price relative to the earnings and the revenue and everything, that's just way too expensive. And it's not the 725 that it's expensive. You could have something traded at $1,000 per share that's cheap, but 725 relative to the earnings that company is producing is just extremely expensive.
Yeah, like I said, 40 times multiple, that's crazy. I'm just going to leave it there. Next company I want to look at here, too, is Marvell Technology, or I think it's Marvell. The shares actually fell here recently after their Q1 guidance fell short. And I think the stock was down, gosh, close to like 20%. I mean, it was quite a big hit. So I thought, hey, this is in the AI space. You know, maybe there's some potential here with a pullback in the stock. Want to take a closer look at what the numbers look like again for Marvell Technology. Their ticker symbol is MRVL. So looking at the short percentage here, it's 3.1%. Price to earnings, not material, nothing there. Price to sales, it's expensive at 10.5 versus an industry average of 9.9. Immaterial price to tangible book value, price to cash flow, also expenses at 42 versus the industry average of 31.3. Don't see anything for the earnings per share over the last 1 year. I wonder if they've declined here a decent amount. Sales over the last 1 year, they are down 7%, while the industry was actually up 35%. So I wonder if they're having some issues with the AI hype and maybe not capturing as much as some of the other players there. Now, the five-year estimated growth rate, 18.2%, that does look attractive. But again, want to understand what exactly are they doing in AI, and is that something that can actually capture market share in? Dividend yield, again, not really material, at 0.4%. No payout ratio with no earnings there. Current ratio, very strong, 1.7, so plenty of liquidity there. Debt to equity at 0.3, so strong balance sheet for Marvell Technology. Looking at the net profit margin, negative 16.9%. That's disappointing, considering the industry average at 19.7%. And then looking at the current price for Marvell, $66.87. 52-week high here, $85.76, while the 52-week low, $36.75. So even with that pullback after earnings, stock's still up about 11% year to date. So it's still doing pretty darn well, I would say. Looking forward, though, for the company about to January 2026, I do see estimated earnings per share of $2.48. That would give us a target sell price here of $41.17. So it's still well below the current price. It means it's trading at about 27 times earnings, not as expensive as Costco, but still too expensive for my liking. And one other thing, too, that the main reason I wanted to look at this company was understanding what we call GAAP accounting. It's generally accepted accounting principles versus what is called pre-accept, non-GAAP numbers, where companies can actually back out things like stock-based compensation is generally a technology company's kind of favorite thing to back out. And I'm going to say Marvell Technology, they're a huge, huge abuser of this. They had, let's see here, GAAP earnings, or actually a GAAP loss of $392.7 million in the first quarter, which was a loss of 45 cents per share. But after they did all that, I'm going to say kind of fancy accounting, kind of backing out those expenses that they wanted to, their non-GAAP earnings were $401.6 million or 46 cents per share. I mean, that's a huge abuse. And if you own shares in a company like this, you always want to understand the discrepancy between the GAAP and the non-GAAP. I'll tell you, sometimes I don't want to say it's okay, but it's understandable when they back out certain expenses from the GAAP numbers. But an abuse like that, I mean, that is a huge discrepancy. I would be very, very careful with holding a company like Marvell.
Maybe if they made some better movies and shows, they'd be doing a little bit better.
Maybe. You know, sometimes it's funny that there was a company when Zoom went public that they actually were a Chinese company and they were a beneficiary from Zoom going public, and people accidentally bought that Zoom stock. I bet you there's people out there that think this is Marvell.
Well, I was joking because this is a different Marvell. That Marvell has been purchased by Disney. That doesn't have a stock that trades. This is a different Marvell.
Well, again, unfortunately, it's another sell here. So 0-2, I'm going to say today. But with that, let's talk real estate. Is Robert ready for us here? Let's go out to Robert Behick, again, president of Countywide Mortgage. Robert, you there with us today?
Good morning, gentlemen. I'm here.
Good morning. Good to have you. So I know it looks like your topic today is buying a home with a co-signer or a partner. So I'm going to give you the floor here and kind of expand a little bit upon what you're talking about.
So I just had some folks that were looking at buying a house, and they decided to co-sign for their nephew, who is going to college, and they bought what we call a kitty condo. He doesn't have a lot of income, but the uncle and aunt are able to co-sign for him and use their income to help them buy property. And it's one of the things that we're seeing more and more folks go to, because folks can afford the payment, but they don't have a down payment. And if you're going to be paying for room and board away from school or somewhere else, it could be a viable option.
Now, I mean, obviously, many times you say if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. I mean, is there any, you know, downsides here? Are the aunts and uncles, are they taking on any risk that they need to be aware of when they co-sign for a nephew, or if you're doing it for a son or a child of yours?
There's always risk. Absolutely. If somebody doesn't make a payment, then it's going to affect their credit. But here's the thing. They're going to have to make a payment, making rent payments anyway. Mm-hmm. So a lot of this stuff is where the numbers come out, does it make sense or not? Mm-hmm. But there is always risk, sure.
Is that something, I guess, that you talk with your clients about? And, you know, obviously, I know sometimes we have hard conversations with the clients, but, you know, we tend to think highly of our kids and you know, family members. Is it a conversation you got to have with, you know, is little Billy, is he going to be able to make the payments, or are you going to be on top of him? I mean, is there ways that they can help kind of reduce their risk, I guess?
So after doing this for 37 years, I don't count on Billy, who's just going to college, to make the payment. That's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah.
It would be more of, little Billy's got a condo and he's got a roommate in who's helping him pay a mom and dad, or aunt and uncle in this case, are flipping the bill, but aunt and uncle are going to retain the investment when little Billy's done.
And how often do you see this? Because I'm assuming that this happens more and more with parents and kids, or aunt and uncles and nephews. Do you also see this with business partners co-signing and working together to acquire property?
Great question. So right now, unfortunately, because the economy being what it is, we're seeing a few more divorces.
Yeah.
And folks are taking money and they're going to other folks and actually buying with them. The biggest key to this is that they don't have to be an occupant, right? As a partner, I don't want to have to live there. I may have my own house or live across the country, but it's still a viable option.
Now, as a co-signer, I mean, is there anything you put in there, or do you recommend people put in there about, you know, potentially taking equity in that property, or is there any way to kind of, or is this purely like to help out your nephew, help out your child there?
No, it's the child is the one that's the nephew in this case is going to help by paying a little bit of rent, and he's going to help by managing a little bit. And when they graduate, they're going to sell the property and take whatever profit there is and give Billy, for example, a little bit of money, and the rest they're going to keep.
Well, very good, very good. Yeah, I know it's definitely a tough market here in San Diego, to say the least. Do you have something there,
Well,
Harrison?
This is all, I mean, it's something that is an option if you understand what you're getting into, because, I mean, renting is so expensive in San Diego and really all across the country. So this could be a situation where, if it's done correctly, you know, it can help out the nephew, but it also can help out the aunt and uncle who are in there, you know, as long as you understand what the risks are. But it definitely seems like there's value that can be added by looking at it from that perspective.
Yeah, I know that's something you guys definitely take pride on there, Robert. Is I know you guys always say it starts with conversation and kind of being more partners. And why don't you give people, again, the best way to get a hold of you, so, you know, if they want to start that conversation with you and your company?
Cell phone 760-443-3821. That number again, 760-443-3821. Or our website is countywidemtg.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Robert. We always appreciate the insight.
Have a great day, gentlemen.
All right, you too. Again, that's Robert B. Hick from Countywide Mortgage Lending. And they're actually one of the top 100 mortgage companies in America since 2012. And has been serving the community for over 30 years. So he's seen a lot of different situations like we just talked about. Again, you want to get a hold of Robert, you can visit them on their website, countywidemtg.com. Again, countywidemtg.com.
Countywide Mortgage Lending is a division of Golden Empire Mortgage, Incorporated, NMLS number 1104585. licensed by the Department of Financial Protection and an Innovation under the California Residential Mortgage Lending Act. Countywide Mortgage Lending is an equal housing lender and proud member of the BBB.
Next up, I did want to talk about a stock here. I'm going to say I was a little excited in it crashed, not necessarily what you want to crash, but Southwest, LUV, you know, this airline, I think, has been kind of one of the better run airlines over history. I know they've kind of had some issues as of late, and actually the stock got hit pretty hard this past week. They had kind of some downbeat guidance. They had what's known as RASM, which is revenue per available seat mile. They guided down to be flat to up 2%. Their prior estimate was for a gain of 2.5% to 4.5% increase. Also, to their available seat miles actually was up 11% versus the prior estimate at 10%. I was kind of surprised by that, considering some issues with Boeing. This is something I kind of talked about earlier in the show, but energy prices being problematic. Fuel cost per gallon estimated to be $2.95 to $3 compared to their prior estimate of $2.70 versus $2.80. And they do expect a net loss now in Q1, but do return to expect profitability in March. And also, too, they pointed out that they expect lower than anticipated leisure passenger volume. I don't know if maybe people traveling is slowing down. It's been so hot, and this is kind of one thing that's kept me, I'm going to say, out of the airlines, maybe out of restaurants, is they've been such a hot place in the economy. Can that continue? And if not, are these stocks going to get hit? I'll take a closer look at the numbers here, because the stock did fall, maybe prompting a value opportunity in Southwest. And the big thing as well that we know about, Boeing expected to deliver 46 737-8 aircrafts in 2024 versus expectations of 79 deliveries. So, I mean, that's going to really hurt, I think, their growth plans. And we'll see how Boeing kind of can maybe get back on track to help Southwest and help the other airlines, because it's going to be problematic if they can't actually get onto the plan that they initially had in place. So it did hit the stock. I think they were down, gosh, double digits a few days ago. So I say, hey, let's take a look at Southwest. The ticker symbol here is LUV. Short percentage of float here, 3.6%. You know, not too high, not extremely low, so there's a little bit of short position on it. Valuation is a little bit disappointed on this. Price to earnings multiple 37.4, above the industry average of 15.3. Price to sales of 0.7, also above the industry average of 0.5. I see price to tangible book value here 1.8, well below the industry average of 7.6. That's a strong measure. Plus two, price to cash flow of 5.7, above the industry average of 3.6. Now, looking at the PEG ratio, this is positive. 0.9, nice PEG ratio below 1. I like to see that. That's coming from a 5-year estimated growth rate of 22.5%. So analysts are expecting, it looks like, some growth on those earnings going forward. As I mentioned, they are maybe looking at a return to profitability in March of this year. If they can get back on track, hey, this could be a good opportunity to enter the stock potentially. Looking at the earnings growth over the last year, it was actually a decline at 12.6%. Sales grew 9.6% over last year, while the industry average was up 21.8%. So definitely lagging the industry there. Dividend, not bad. 2.5% yield for Southwest. Looking at the balance sheet, current ratio 1.1, so good liquidity. Good balance sheet here in terms of the debt to equity as well. 0.9, well below the industry average of 3. I know there's several other airlines out there that just scare the heck out of me when it comes to their debt levels. Southwest has always been one that's been able to kind of manage that balance sheet, I'm going to say, quite well. Looking at the profit margin, 1.8% below the industry average of 3.9. I want to understand kind of, again, what's happened. Why is Southwest not profitable right now? As I said, you know, travel's been doing great. You know, gas prices, oil prices, they've been quite subdued. So why are they not able to kind of turn those higher margins? Would definitely want to understand what's going on with the business there. Is that could be a little concerning. Looking at the current price for Southwest, though, it is $28.35, the 52-week high, $39.53, and the 52-week low, $21.91. So I see the year-to-date, frankly, the stock's not down as much as I thought it was. Year-to-date, it's down 1.3%. We see over the last week, I mentioned that mistake that kind of came out, not mistake, but that downbeat guidance that came out hit the stock. Over the last 5 days, the stock is down 17.3%, which kind of, again, piqued my interest a little bit in this particular stock. Now, going forward, going out to December 2025, I do see estimated earnings per share here for, again, Southwest, their ticker symbol LUV. $2.39 is what we're looking at for the estimate. That gives us a target sell price of $39.67. I'm going to say substantially above that current price of $28.35. You get a nice forward PE multiple, slightly under 12. I mean, the values are definitely there, but there's question marks. I know a couple of years ago they kind of had some issues with flight delays and kind of scheduling issues. Have they resolved those? Is that why earnings are kind of downbeat for the company? I mean, there's some major question marks, but this is a good brand name, good valuations. I think that it's a possibility, and I think it could be worth some further research there.
Is that something that could be hit by unions as well? Are there unions for airlines?
Pilots did strike. I believe that did impact Southwest. I don't know if that's come to a resolution. I believe I heard it has, but I'm not sure what the deal looks like and how much of an impact that'll have on earnings. But that's definitely something as an investor you'd want to understand what that looks like for Southwest. All right. The last company here I want to talk about today was Kroger. Again, their ticker symbol is KR, and you may recognize, obviously, Kroger. They own several other companies as well. They do own Ralph's, Food for Less, Fry's. Also, too, they've kind of announced an acquisition potentially of Albertsons, and Albertsons owns Vaughn's, Safeway, Hagen. So, I mean, this is a very interesting potential deal. It's gotten a lot of backlash from the FTC. They're actually set for a court date, looks like August 26th. I mean, the deal was initially announced in October of 2022 that Kroger would buy Albertsons for $34.10 per share. And again, here we are in 2024 with a court date for August, so that this thing might not close for 2 years even after it was first announced. And the big concern here is that, you know, Kroger's too big, that they're buying up the next largest competitor. But the thing that people don't realize is Walmart and Costco are actually Kroger's main competitors. In 2023, Walmart actually held 23.6% of the market share in grocery retailers by dollar share. Kroger was at 10.1%, Costco at 9.2%. Albertsons was at 6.4. So even if you combine Kroger and Albertsons, I mean, it's 16%. They're still not even at Walmart, and they'd still be, I'd say, competing against Costco. I haven't looked through the merger in too much detail to be kind of pro or against it. But I mean, just from a purely market share perspective, this wouldn't necessarily create a company that would control 50, 70% of the market. I don't see why this is as big of a deal as some people are pointing it out to be. I mean, Walmart essentially is kind of running away with the business, it seems like, and these companies, the traditional grocers, are having a hard time competing. But thought it might make sense to take a look at it because I think the stocks have struggled somewhat, and maybe this merger could be a good potential growth story, as, you know, generally size enables, you know, cost cutting, synergies, which could lead to some benefits in terms of profits for Kroger as well. So with that, let's take a look at Kroger real quick. Their ticker symbol is KR. See a nice price to earnings multiple of 19, below the industry average of 23.9. I see price to sales at 0.3, below the industry average is 0.4. Price to tangible book value, 5.2. Wow, industry average, 93.8. Price to cash flow, 6, same as the industry average of 6. Peg ratio, 1.5. That comes from an estimated 5-year growth rate for those earnings of 8%. I like both those ratios, especially for a company that I'm going to say is quite simplistic. Now, earnings over the last 1 year for Kroger, they're down 16%, while sales were essentially flat at down just 0.3%, while the industry was down 1.7%. That could be coming from, obviously, food prices not being as hot on the inflation report, just kind of carrying through on the sales volume. Now, dividend, you get a 2.1% dividend yield for Kroger. They only use 41% of their earnings to pay that out, so I'd say that's positive. That dividend can likely still occur. The balance sheet, I'm going to say I'm disappointed. Current ratio is 0.8. That's fine, but the debt to equity at 1.8 is a little bit high, especially if you add on a acquisition of Albertsons. I mean, that's a $25 billion deal. And last I checked Albertsons' balance sheet as well, their debt level was not pretty. So, I mean, that could cause problems for Kroger if that deal goes through. I mean, their debt to equity could skyrocket. Definitely something to keep an eye on. Net margin for Kroger at 1.3% is above the industry average of 1.1%. And also, too, looking at the current price, it's $56.06. 52-week high here, $56.20. 52-week low, $42.10. I'm going to say I'm a little misguided. The stock's actually done pretty well. Year to date, it's up 23.4%, or the last 1 year up 21.7%. The 3 year return 68.6%. 5 year return 152.6%. So, I mean, Kroger, the numbers there are actually not bad in terms of the performance. Curious to see again how Albertson's stock has done. I know they're trading well off the estimated deal price for Kroger's estimated buyout, but gotta say, surprised by the performance for Kroger. Going forward, though, for Kroger to get that target sell price, I go out to January 2026. I see estimated earnings per share of $4.56. Gives us a target sell price here of $75.70. Means the stock's trading around 12 times earnings. I mean, not a bad valuation there. I like the business. Again, it's something that we know people need to buy groceries. It's not going anywhere. I don't think I'd be entering at this point. And also, too, I got those questions over the balance sheet. I mean, that is always a major, major concern for me. I mean, because everything can be fine, and all of a sudden, maybe we have, you know, something major happen in the food industry. Things become a major issue, and then that debt causes them into bankruptcy. So, got to be careful with that. But thank you for listening to the Smart Investing Show. It is for informational purposes only and should not be used as investment advice. If you would like to discuss in more detail your investment needs or have other investment questions, feel free to call myself, Chase Wilsey, or Brent Wilsey as well at 858-224-0004. Please visit our website, smartinvesting2000.com. Again, that's smartinvesting2000.com. I find it all so amusing to think I did all that. And may I say,